Welcome to PM Lessons Learned, a podcast for project managers, helping project managers by sharing lessons learned. Increase your PM knowledge, build business relationships, increase your effectiveness, increase your marketability, gain professional support. Join our group and take part in our conference calls. Details at pmlessonslearned.com.
Hello, and welcome to the PM Lessons Learned Monthly PMP Exam Study Group Conference Call and Podcast. This is podcast number 106. We are recording this session on the 7th of October, 2010, and we are totally focused on version 4 of the PMBOK Guide. My name is Dana Safford. I'm your host for the PM Lessons Learned Monthly PMP Exam Study Group Conference Calls. I've been a PMP since version 2000 of the PMBOK. I'm also an ITIL version 3 expert and a Microsoft certified systems engineer. I have over 25 years of project management experience in the IT industry. I work for Hewlett-Packard as a complex problem manager. In this role, I take a very complex situation that is affecting an HP customer's enterprise production environment, and I manage a project with a virtual technical team that quickly resolves the issue. So remember, you don't have to have the term project manager in your job title to actually be a project manager. Our presenter for this session is me. And our topic is Project Human Resource Management. The PMP examination is based on version 4 of the Guide to Project Management Body of Knowledge, or the PMBOK. This month's PM Lessons Learned Monthly PMP Exam Study Group Conference Call focuses on the Project Human Resource Management knowledge area as it's laid out in PMBOK version 4. There are changes in this area, and I'll attempt to provide you with insight and practical examples of everything you will need to know to build your critical knowledge mass and pass the PMP exam on the first attempt. So if you haven't downloaded a copy of today's presentation, you can find those in our PM Lessons Learned website. So to download all those files from this session and from other PM Lessons Learned sessions, go to www.pmlessonslearned.com, and in the left-hand navigation column, you'll see a link to files and presentations. Okay, the file name for this session is PMLL Human Resource Management 7 October 10, and it's a PDF file. Its title is the same thing, PMLL Human Resource Management 7 October 10. In the file area, you'll also see the content from about a year's worth of conference calls, and an updated PMBOK version 4 brain dump is in there as well. If you look in the past PMP exam study group calls folder, you'll find several years' worth of stuff in there. But be very careful with those files because they pretty much all are based on version 3 of the PMBOK guide. PMBOK 4 has been the testing source for over a year now, but the old stuff is there as well. You may remember there's roughly about a 30% difference from version 3 to version 4, and it's pretty much all in their processes, their inputs, tools and techniques, and outputs, or ITTOs. And finally, this is the monthly PM Lessons Learned PMP Study Group Conference Call and Podcast. If you're on a shorter time scale and are willing to make a commitment to actively participate and take turns presenting study group material, our weekly PMP Exam Study Group may be the right place for you. For more information, send an email to pmpstudy@pmlessonslearned.com. So, we are pmlessonslearned.com. Project managers helping project managers to make a difference. I thank you in advance to all the participants in this month's live conference call and all those that download and use the podcast. So let's get started. What we have is the first slide, slide number one. And this is basically the listing of all of our conference calls, this being the first Thursday of the month. We have the PMP Study Group conference call, the monthly version. On the second Thursday of the month, we have the PM Job Shop call. So if you're in transition or looking for a job or trying to bolster your resume, that's the place to go. And then finally, on the third Thursday of the month, we have the PM Lessons Learned Best Practices Conference Call, where our founder, Henry Will, hosts a session on a project management topic, various authors and practitioners and the like. So if you're free for any of those Thursdays, please stop by and join us. It's all the same number, all the same website. Just pick which Thursday you want to talk about. You can also listen to the previous calls by phone or download the podcast or the slides. You can find all that information at our website, www.pmlessonslearned.com, and you can join our Yahoo and LinkedIn groups, all with the same name, PM Lessons Learned. I'm going to move to the next slide. and let you know that this is an interactive call. We really want you to participate. I don't mind being interrupted at all. You're muted right now if you're on the phone, so you'll need to do a *6 in order to unmute your phone. If you want to get my attention, ask a question, by all means, do that. Don't mind being interrupted at all. I just don't want to talk over you, so get my attention, and then I'll be quiet for a while, and you can ask your question. Moving on to the next slide, here's our email address, pmpstudy@pmlessonslearned.com. Any questions at all you might have, you want to volunteer for something, you have something you'd like to share, that's the email address to use. Moving on to the next slide, we have some legalese. What I hope all of you will do with these slides is use them as additional study material. As such, there are more words and text in these than there are graphics, because it's really tough to look at a graphic and try to discern what the presenter wanted. In this case, you've got text. You can read it. It's in English, but hopefully you can read English and know what's going on. And much of the session comes from a study guide by Kim Heldman, put out by John Wiley and Sons, part of the CYBEX series. It's the Project Management Professional Exam Study Guide, the 5th edition. That's the edition that has PMBOK version 4 in it. Don't use earlier versions. There are some out there. You see the ISBN number so that you can order that book. It's a pretty concise paperback journal with a CD in the back that has a test engine, practice tests, audio, a whole bunch of different things, all for about $40 to $60 U.S., depending upon where you get it. So it's a very good value. The information that I'll be using in here comes from that guide, and I'm using this with the permission of the publisher. I'm a registered instructor with John Wiley. So I'm going to move on to the next slide, and it's our title slide for the session today. We'll be talking about the Project Human Resource Management area. Today is the 7th of October, 2010. Moving on to the next slide, we'll get into managing human resources. This whole area includes processes that organize, manage, and lead your project team. And what is your team or your staff comprised of? All the people that are working on your project. They have roles, they have responsibilities assigned to the project so your project will complete. And the number and the scope and the type of team members can vary. You can have a totally different mix from the beginning to the middle to the end of a project. So it will change frequently. And what you want to do is get some good subject matter experts involved in the early stages while you're doing some of your planning. We're doing waterfall planning here, so we're going to plan first and then implement. So we want to make sure that early involvement of several individuals will help you get through your planning a whole lot faster. Moving on to the next slide, we have a rendition of the processes that we'll be talking about today. This is the human resource management knowledge area as laid out in the PMBOK. For those of you new to the PMBOK guide, each one of the 9 knowledge areas are laid out in a similar fashion, the little organization chart type of thing, so that you can follow it along. They'll have some number of processes, anywhere from a couple to 6, and each one of those processes has a number of inputs, tools, and techniques, and outputs. So as you read through these, everything is numbered so you can follow along and understand what's being discussed in any portion of your studying as you move along. Speaking of moving along, I'm going to go to the next slide, and let's get into our first process. It is develop human resource plan. It's number 9.1. We see another graphic. This is figure 9-2 in the PMBOK. All the processes are laid out in a similar manner, as I mentioned, with inputs, tools, and techniques, and outputs. The numbers are how many are in each one of those boxes will vary depending upon the process. And if you want to talk about 9.1.2 as an input, we're talking about the second one. This is the way the whole numbering scheme works. So for this session, we'll be talking about 3 inputs, 3 tools and techniques, and 1 output. So I'm going to move to the next slide, and we'll talk about the inputs. There are 3 of them. I'll read them in case you don't have a screen in front of you. They're activity resource requirements, enterprise environmental factors, and organizational process assets. Since this is pretty much the first process we're talking about tonight, I'll talk about all of these as I work through the session today. If I've already talked about something, I won't belabor it and go over it yet again. But for right now, we're going to move to the next slide and talk about activity resource requirements. These are basically the preliminary requirements regarding the people, what they're good at, what they're expected to be doing. You're going to lay it out one time in a preliminary manner, and then you see in bold, progressively elaborated, progressive elaboration. You'll hear that a lot as you're doing your PMP exam studies. It's the process of going over and over, reiterating certain things, because the first time through you may not know so much. Next time through you know a little bit more, so it's entirely possible that you'll be going over several processes a couple of different times as you're working through your planning process. working through your project. And these are really the outputs of a previous process called defined activities. There's a lot of looping and a lot of data flows going back and forth within all of the processes that are laid out by the PMBOK. And this is an example of that. So the main two things that come from the defined activities process is the activity list and activity attributes. Activity list is just the way it sounds. You've figured out all the activities that you're going to need to accomplish for your project, and the activity list is just that list. It's going to have an identifier on it, probably activity 27.32.46, or whatever numbering scheme you've set up to keep track so you know what you're talking about. You don't have to do things by name. You do it by number because it's easier to find with a number. And then each activity has a set of attributes. Perhaps there's a certain activity that needs a particular resource, a certified crane operator, if you're building a building or a bridge or something along those lines, a bulldozer operator, a carpenter, a programmer, a coder, those type of things. So this is where you get to list the type of attributes that the resource that will be working on that activity requires. Okay, moving on to the next slide. Continuing with our inputs, we have some things you'll see a lot of throughout all of the early stages of any of the knowledge areas, and those are enterprise environmental factors and organizational process assets. Enterprise environmental factors in general are the things you have to deal with because you work in the organization that you're working in right now. It could be a for-profit business, a not-for-profit business, a civic group, a religious group, fraternal group, whatever the case may be, your home, if you're doing projects to build an addition to your house or a deck onto your house or redoing a loft, anything along those lines, because you are in that organization, you have to deal with certain things. And these are those things. They're existing human resources. People are already there, personnel administration policies, locations and technical factors as you're building up on a mountaintop, so it's very difficult to do something that you hope would be doing down by the seashore. Who knows what it might be, but because you're in the organization, you have to deal with it. Where organizational process assets are those little trinkets, those little things that are left behind by people who have come before you. They are the standard processes. Somebody's built and documented a process, a policy, a standardized role descriptions. They've put together templates and checklists and things along those lines. And you can reuse those. There's no reason for you to go off and redesign the wheel every single time. You always want to try to use the information, the expertise of those who came before you. And as you are doing your project, if you develop a nice little checklist, you see in a little while I'm going to talk about OPA updates. You're going to take your checklist, you're going to put it into the OPAs and let someone else use it. So these are things that you want to pay attention to and such to help those who are coming behind you. And I'm going to move on to the next slide. The exam point, that big red honking red bullet there is an exam point. If you see any of these on any of my slides, chances are it's going to be on the test somewhere. It's just a matter of you can't quite guarantee what style of question you'll be seeing it in, but it most likely will be there. And for this one, the PMBOK says using templates and checklists is one way to assure you don't miss anything, any key responsibilities or something along those lines, key steps, key activities. So don't be afraid to use the checklist, use a template, make up your own, use somebody else's. You're going to see a few templates and checklists a few slides from now as well. Moving on to the next slide, we'll also talk about our enterprise environmental factors, triple constraints. You've heard of triple constraints before. You see them overall in project management. Well, EES have their own. They are organizational structures, collective bargaining agreements, and economic conditions. You really want to understand these EEFs because you have to interchange. You have to play these things off of each other because there's an organizational structure that you have to deal with. You might be constrained by so many people or a certain way that maybe you only have a functional organization to deal with and you really want a matrix organization. Well, you don't have one, so that's a constraint you have to deal with. In a collective bargaining agreements, maybe you're going to be using some unionized, some organized labor, organized resources. You have to deal with those bargaining agreements. And then what are the economic conditions going on? Are you in a booming economy, a down economy, and that's going to influence the type and level and expertise of staff that you can find either inside or outside of your organization. It might impact your ability to travel. Perhaps you like to do a lot of face-to-face meetings. Well, if you've got human resources in your project that are on opposite sides of the world and travel is prohibited because it's too expensive and your company's cutting costs, you've got to find other ways to work on your project. Okay, so these are the triple constraints on the EEF side. that you have to pay attention to. Moving on to the next slide, now we'll begin to talk about the tools and techniques of Develop Human Resource Plan. There's three of them. They are organization charts and position descriptions, next networking, and then organizational theory. So I'm going to move to the next slide. We'll talk about all three of these guys as well. We'll talk about the first set of tools and techniques, which are the charts that you can use. We'll talk about three different charts. There are more. We start off with a hierarchical type of chart. It's a traditional organization chart that you're used to seeing. It has a project manager or maybe a sponsor way up at the top, and it has an organization moving downward depending upon what you're trying to set up. This is actually figure 9-4 in the PMBOK, if you're following along in the PMBOK, or if you'd like to reference it in the PMBOK. Next, in the middle of that graphic, there's a matrix-based chart. This is any type of matrix you want to put together, a piece of graph paper, a spreadsheet, a Word document that has names in either the rows or the columns and has functions or roles or something along those lines. Names in the rows, you put functions in the columns, you can do it the other way around. And at the intersection of the row and the column, you're going to put something, either words or graphics or anything along those lines that might give you a clue based on your organization and the EEFs and the OPAs you have to deal with, who's doing what, who has what type of role. And then there's a text-oriented format where you're just going to have a description. It's going to be in a text document somehow. They can go in any of those types of forms. So I'm going to move to the next slide, talk about roles and responsibilities a little bit more with another kind of chart. All of these charts have sort of the same name, the Responsibility Assignment Matrix, or a RAM. You'll see RAM used often. There is a RAM for a Risk Assignment Matrix as well, but for the most part, when you see the question, make sure if it's a human resource question, you know it's a Responsibility Assignment Matrix. If they're talking about risk, you know it's a Risk Assignment Matrix. We've got Responsibility Assignment Matrix here, and this is a matrix document you see down the bottom. There's an example. This is figure 9-5 at the bottom of the slide here. This is called the RACI chart, and it's called the RACI chart because as you do your activities along the rows is the way this one is set up, and your people along the columns, what you do is you pick one of four letters. Now, the PMBOK likes RACI, R-A-C-I, for responsible, accountable, consult, and inform. There are other iterations, versions of this chart that use other letters. That's okay if your organization uses different letters. This is what the PMI wants. This will be what is on the test. So for the test, remember this. For your own projects in your organization, remember what they want to do. But responsible in this case means that's the person doing the work. That's not the same as A, or accountable. That's the person who is accountable for producing the deliverable. So this is most likely a manager. A manager is going to be responsible for producing X amount of work in a project, and they're going to delegate to the person who's responsible, who's doing the work. So A doesn't have to be a management person, but it certainly can be, but it's someone who has to make sure the work is done, not necessarily doing the work. The R is the doer. Okay, and then there's a C for consult. This is somebody who you probably want to check with as you're working through to make sure things are okay. You want to ask their opinion, get them to say yes or no. Where an I for inform is you're not going to ask them, but you're going to let them know. You're just going to send them off an email and say, this is just to let you know this is happening. So if we look at the first line of this chart under the activity called define, we see a list of five names there. We see Ann is the accountable person. You know, and maybe a manager, may not. Typically, you'll see only one A in any RACI chart because normally there's one person accountable, but there may be more than one doer. In this situation, you see only one R for this line. Ben is the responsible person, and everybody else is just going to be informed. Or if you look down at the next one, the design, you see an A and an R because you have to have an A and an R for each one. But now you see some C's. So maybe Dina and Ed, two of those names that are in the chart, would need to be consulted before anything happens. And only one person, Ann, is to be informed. But you get the idea. That's how this whole thing works. And there'll probably be a RACI chart on the exam, most likely. Moving on to the next slide. This is yet another way to look at a RAM chart. This one has more graphics on it. It's called a linear responsibility chart. Same thing. It just does things linearly. You see activities on the rows. You see, instead of named individuals, you see roles along the top. It doesn't matter whether it's a name or it's a role up there. And then you see a legend with circles and triangles and rectangles filled in or not. It gives you an idea of who's supposed to do what. So it's yet another way to chart responsibilities. Okay, so I'm going to move on to the next slide, and we talk about two more tools and techniques is networking and organizational theory. Networking is just what you've come to know that it means. You're talking with individuals, you're dealing with people as you're working on your project, as you're working between projects, and you learn things, you know things. There's politics, there's interpersonal factors that come into play, but you're dealing with individuals. So networking is a tool and technique you can do in your project. And then there's organizational theory. The Pinbach in the first couple, three chapters talks a lot about organizational theory, whether they work in a matrix organization or a functional organization, those types of things. All of that stuff dictates how you're going to do your project. And there are things that you must consider when you're developing a human resource plan based on what type of organization you're dealing in. Okay, so I'm going to move on to the next slide, and we'll talk about the outputs involved now with develop human resource plan. There's basically a couple of outputs here, but the major part is the human resource plan itself. It's a hunk of the project management plan. It can be a paragraph if it's a real short project, but it's going to be a section most likely, depending on how large your project is. And it's got a bunch of stuff in there. It's probably going to list out the roles and responsibilities of the individuals working on your project. It'll probably say, if it's a software development project, you're going to need so many coders, so many testers, so many requirement specialists, those types of things. And you're going to play that out, and you're going to figure out the numbers and whatever. But as you work through this, you need to come up with a role, and it's going to describe what portion of the project this person is accountable for and what their job is going to be, perhaps. Then you're going to have the authority that they have. What are they going to be able to do in this project? Can they make decisions? Can they sign things? Whatever the case may be. And what is their responsibility? What are they expected to perform? What are they expected to do in order to work on your project and complete your project? And then maybe there's some competency that's involved. Maybe you need lawyers that have passed the bar in your organization, or certified project managers, PMPs, or certified technologists somehow, certified crane operators, or things along those lines. It all depends on what you need. So you set certain levels of competency for the people that you're dealing with. Then you've got to have an organization chart, as we saw a few slides back. And you probably come up with a staffing management plan, because depending upon the size of your project, your staffing might vary. On a short project, you might have the same set of individuals for the entire project and be done. But if it's a large project or a longer-term project, you're probably going to start small, you're going to ramp up to some point, and then you're going to ebb and flow for a while as you are executing and monitoring and controlling your project. And eventually, when the project is complete, you're going to ramp down. And that's where your staffing management plan comes in, because you've got to figure out all of that. So let's move to the next slide and actually talk about what goes into a staffing management plan. Basically, it's going to document how you're going to introduce and remove resources from your project. There'll hopefully be a section in there for staff acquisition, describing how they're going to be acquired. Are they exclusively inside, exclusively outside? Is there a mix? Where they're located, costs maybe, or skills, things along those lines. There'll be a timetable. If you're not ready to use that crane operator for the first 3 months of your project, you don't need to bring the crane operator on. You'll bring that crane operator on 3 months in, type of thing. So it'll be a timetable. And then if you're done with the crane 3 months before the project ends, then you're going to release the crane operator, which is the next section, release criteria. How do you release them, and what do you have to do in order to release them? It'd be nice if you're a due diligent project manager, maybe helping them find the next assignment if you're releasing somebody. And maybe there's training needs that they need. Maybe if they have the right skills coming in, fantastic, but if they don't, maybe you have to get them into a school or a class of some kind before they start working on your project. So you need to pay attention to that. Then there's rewards and recognition. You need to have some way to recognize and reward people. We'll talk about that in a few more slides as well. Maybe there's compliance things you have to pay attention to, various rules, regulations, laws, things along those lines. You have to know about those. And then safety. Make sure everything is done so that there are no safety issues. So those are the types of things you need in a staffing management plan. And the last slide in this section that we'll talk about is just one of the other tools that you can use. It is a staffing resource histogram. It shows in either dollars, hours, bodies, whatever you'd like to use on that y-axis, and then normally you see a time axis along the bottom, either days, weeks, months, years, whatever the case may be, and basically are plotting what your staffing is. You can see staffing in this one ebbs and flows. starts small the first week, bumps up the second week, ebbs and flows a little bit in the middle, then drops off, and then there's a lull, and then a little bit more. So this is just an example of something that you can use. One of these might be on the test as well, asking you, why do the resources fall off in the first week of April, perhaps? Well, because the project has ended and such, you never know. Okay, so there's that. I'm going to move on to the next slide, and we'll talk about a second process for this session. This is Acquire Project Team. It's process 9.2, and we have three inputs, four tools and techniques, and three outputs. So let's just go to the next slide and begin to talk about the Acquire Project Team process. This involves getting people, acquiring people, receiving people, human resources that you need in order to do your project. They can come from anywhere inside the company, inside the group, outside the group. It all depends on the circles that you travel in, what your organization tends to do. As a project manager, you need to make sure that the resources are available and trained or skilled for the project that you are having them work on. It's your responsibility to do that. If you're handed somebody who isn't trained, you need to sing out and either get that training established for that individual or talk to your sponsors if that person is assigned to you and say, this person needs to be trained, needs more training. What are you going to do to help me get that training? The sponsors are there to help remove roadblocks. Having unskilled people on your project is a roadblock. So as you work through your own projects, you're going to find people will be handed to you all the time. I just picked up a project 2 weeks ago. I've got a dozen people who I didn't choose. They were all handed to me. We've had our kickoff meeting. We've had a couple of team meetings, and we're getting there. Some people knew each other ahead of time. Some didn't, but I'm communicating with them, and we're making progress. So just because you don't know anybody on your team doesn't mean you can't make progress. Because everybody, as long as you set out the goals and everybody knows what they're doing, and we'll talk about that in a few slides. So that bottom bullet there is use your sponsor as much as possible. If you have a good sponsor or well-placed stakeholder, if they handpick the people for you for whatever reason, because they have the capability, the power, whatever, then use that sponsor to help you out. Make sure that you have the right mix of people to get your project done. I'm going to move to the next slide. We'll talk about the inputs for Acquire Project Team. There are three of them. It's project management plan, enterprise environmental factors, and organizational process assets. We've already talked about EEFs and OPAs, but I'm going to be talking about specific ones more than just the generic ones that we talked about earlier. So I'm going to move to the next slide. And the first thing we start up with is the project management plan as an input. So we already know that it contains the human resource plan. We talked about that a little while ago. It maybe will provide guidance on how things will be done. You talk to your sponsors, and your sponsors laid out how they want things to happen. Maybe it talks about roles and responsibilities, things along those lines, organization charts, anything that we've talked about in the past couple of slides could be in your project management plan. So just be aware that you have to look to there for guidance is the point here. Moving to the next slide, then we have some other EEFs and OPAs. The first EEF is understanding special skills. If you need a Six Sigma black belt to do something, whatever the case may be, you have to have a Six Sigma black belt. So somebody has to come up with one. You need to find where you can source, where you can acquire that type of individual. And maybe there's other personal interest characteristics, availability, who knows, whatever the case may be. But those are the things you have to deal with because you're in that company that you have to pay attention to. The exam point that you have there is that even though these things are considered part of your EEFs and part of an input, you really need to understand how they impact the entire acquire process. So don't just look at them as an input. Look at them as how can you deal with these things for a tool, and maybe what can you do as an output for some of these special skill requirements. Okay, and then for OPAs, maybe you have certain recruitment practices that your organization makes you follow, and you need to make sure that you follow those recruitment practices, whatever they might be. Okay, I'm going to move to the next slide, and we'll talk about tools and techniques for Acquire Project Team. There are four of them: pre-assignment, negotiation, acquisition, and virtual teams. Read them off in case you're driving your car or walking the dog or whatever while this podcast is going on and you don't have a screen in front of you. So let's move to the next slide, and we'll talk about these things. We start off with pre-assignment. Pre-assignment occurs when the project is put out for bid and maybe specific team members are promised something as a reward for the previous project they worked on. This is the follow-on, or this is the next step up the chain of responsibility, organization, promotional, whatever the case may be. So there may be people that are pre-assigned to your project. You may or may not have a say in whether they are in your project or not. Sometimes it doesn't matter. If they have the right level of skills, then fine. You work out the personality things. We'll talk about soft skills in a little while. But you work out the personality things because you have to be aware that if they're pre-assigned, they may want to be pre-assigned. You don't want to come in saying, well, why are you here type of thing. And then there's negotiations. Perhaps as part of your organization, you have to negotiate for everything, or maybe a portion you negotiate for. So you want to pick a person from one subgroup. You want to pick a couple of coders. You need a couple of testers. You need a couple of requirements people. If it's an IT coding project, pick a couple of plumbers, a couple of electricians if it's a building project, that type of thing. And you have to negotiate for those people. You have to negotiate time. Maybe you have to negotiate rate. Maybe you have to negotiate their expertise level. It's all something that you work through. And then there's acquisition. Maybe you actually have to hire the individuals, bringing them in either to the company brand new or doing a transfer with some organizations. People transfer between sub-organizations as part of a longer-term project. It all depends on your organization, so there may be some acquisition work that you have to do there. I'm going to move on to the next slide and talk a bit about virtual teams. The PMI and PMBOK is finally paying more attention to virtual teams because when this flat world in a recession, virtual teams are something you have to deal with. Virtual teams are your team members don't necessarily work in the same physical location, or maybe they do, but they work at a different work shift. Maybe they're a night person. Maybe they're a day person. It depends. Everyone isn't in the same place at the same time, same physical place at the same time. The good news is the current technology allows us to be pretty much anywhere and run a project or participate in a project. The one that I told you I just picked up, half of my people are in California, another half are down south. I'm never going to meet these people, but we all work together. We meet a couple times a week in virtual rooms and things along those lines, and we work together. So there's lots of things you can do between chat rooms, virtual rooms, video conferencing, online collaboration tools like what we're using now, the freeseed.com thing. So we use virtual rooms a lot in Hewlett-Packard because we're spread out all over the place. You can do the same thing with your projects. You're trying to work on a document. You can display the document, work on the document with a bunch of people virtually looking over your shoulder and wordsmithing a document, editing something. Looking at, you've got an IT project that's gone awry and something's not working right. You can display the console on the screen and people in other parts of the world can be looking at the same console and helping you figure out what's going on. But as the project manager for a virtual team, you need to make sure that you are communicating a whole lot more than what you do in a regular project where everyone's co-located, because people who are not there don't get the hallway conversation so much. Now, you can attempt to set up live, persistent chat rooms, and everybody has to be in the chat room when they're working so that you can have those types of hallway conversations. Someone can say, hey, how do I do this? How do I do that? And people in the chat room can respond, but you don't necessarily get that if you don't enforce it and make sure everyone is communicating. So make sure that everyone understands the expectations. You must be in the chat room and participating whenever you're working, those types of things. Set the expectations and people will follow them. The other thing is the virtual team members don't necessarily know what their other teammates have done. They don't see that perhaps person A is in their office after hours. But if you have a virtual chat thing set up, they might see that your presence indicator is still green, and it's 9:51 at night, and you're only working 8 to 5 normally. Well, you're working. You're doing extra hours. They can see that, but you have to have those things set up. And if you don't have them set up, then you have to make sure people are aware that person A has been working extra hours, what contribution they've done. They made a huge breakthrough on Project X, whatever it happens to be. So you let other people know that folks are doing their part is one way to say that. And if you have some outstanding performers, you let everybody know there are outstanding performers there. Okay, I'm going to move on to the next slide, and we'll talk about the outputs for Acquire Project Team. There's three of them. I'm going to talk about two. The three outputs are project staff assignment, resource calendars, and project management plan updates. I'm not going to worry about project management plan updates. You can figure that out. If you notice something has to change, you change it. Pretty easy. So I'm going to move to the next slide and talk about project staff assignments. This is where you're actually going to do the assignment. Person A is going to the project. Person B is going to the project. Person G is going to the project. And what you now have to do is fill out your resources in the project, make sure that you've got all the assignments set up. You need to determine roles and responsibilities and timings and things along those lines, assign them to their specific activities, and then publish the fact that they've been assigned. Maybe you're going to do a project organization chart, a RAM chart. An email will do the same thing with a text list. That works fine, whatever works out. But you're letting the world know your assignments. And then there are resource calendars. Everybody and everything has a resource calendar. A bulldozer has a resource calendar. A crane has a resource calendar. A generator has a resource calendar. People also have resource calendars, of course. But as you work through a project and you need to schedule things in and out, you have to be aware of what their resource calendar is. Everything has a resource calendar attached to it, and you need to understand and put your project requirements into those resource calendars so that you get what you want when you need it. And maybe there's the computerized tools that will make all this happen, and you can do composite resource calendars and mix and match and things along those lines and figure out what you really have to juggle from one project to the next if you have to juggle and share things. But that's how resource calendars work out. Move on to the next slide, and then we'll go on to our next process. This is figure 9-9. This is develop project team, process number 9.3. And we'll see we'll have 3 inputs, 6 tools and techniques, and 2 outputs. So I'm going to go to the next slide and begin to talk about develop project team. With this process here, this is all about creating an environment for your team to work effectively. You need to be open, you need to be communicative, you need to be nurturing, and you want to make sure you have an effective, functioning, and coordinated group. That's what all this is all about. One of the major things about project management is making your team, not making, but allowing your team to work together. Maybe it's making too, but for the greatest part, you'd hope that they would want to do that, and you're just going to facilitate, and they're going to work together. We'll get into a whole lot of motivational theories in a few slides. Projects are performed by individuals, and the more they know, the more that they are better informed, the better they will work together, and your project will work out much better. I'm going to move to the next slide and begin to talk about some of the things you need to do as you're working through and developing your team. You need to make sure that you have properly developed your team so that everyone is capable of doing the activities and the role that they are assigned. You need to make sure that they understand what's critical to success. They need to understand what type of training and development they need, and you need to understand those things as well to make sure their skills are moving along. And sometimes you might have to work with a functional manager, depending upon what type of organization you are in, because you don't get to train them. Maybe the functional manager needs to do that. It all depends on the politics and such in your organization. But you're going to work with other people, is the point of that bottom bullet down there, so that you can have the right level of individual for your project. And move on to the next slide. We'll talk about the inputs for develop project team. There are 3 of them, and we're basically not going to talk about any of them. Why? Because we already did. Those inputs are project staff assignments. We talked about that as an output a while back. Project management plan. We talked about that as both an input and an output a while back. And we just talked about resource calendars a moment ago. So remember, the inputs are project staff assignments, project management plan, and resource calendars. But we're moving on to tools and techniques, because there's things there that we have not talked about. The tools and techniques, there's a bunch of these guys, there's 6 of them, I'm going to read them out. Interpersonal skills, training, team building activities, ground rules, co-location, reward and recognition are the 6 that we'll talk about that are tools and techniques. There are a lot of sub-bullets in there, and we'll get to those as we get into the details of each one of those. All right, so let's move to the next slide and talk about the first one, which is interpersonal skills. These are often referred to as soft skills. Pinbock, in the first few chapters, talks a lot about soft skills as well. We'll probably do a session here on soft skills sometime in the next few months as well, because I think I've got a little bit more to finish up in the cost knowledge area, and then we'll be doing some generic stuff before we start talking about process groups. So soft skills are something that are very important to things as leadership, influence, negotiation, communications, all those types of things that help not only a project manager but the team members as well. Everyone has varying degrees of those types of things. Some people have more soft skills than others. Some people have more interpersonal skills than others. As a manager, you need to make sure you have a very strong set of soft skills. They can be learned, but more often than not, they're part of your personality, the A type of personality, perhaps. The more aggressive, self-actuated type of personality is one that have better soft skills built up over time. But if not, you can go to classes. You can learn all this stuff as well. Being a manager implies that you need general knowledge management skills to understand what's going on and manage people. So, yeah, you need that stuff as well. But you also need leadership and negotiation skills to influence other organizations, so for your resources and for other pieces of your project as well. So I'm going to move on to the next slide. And next we talk about training. And with training, basically, we need to make sure that all of the people on your team, as I've mentioned before, have the right knowledge, the right skill set in order to carry out your assigned tasks. So perhaps there is a baseline that you have to have people meet. Now, there's several ways to get there. You can find someone that's already at that level and be set, but if you've been a project manager for a while and you know somebody who has worked on a past project at a junior level, maybe with some training, one of the rewards you can do is get that person the training that they need and bring them onto your project if you think that person has a lot of good capabilities. So training can be a reward as well as a detriment. Some people may have to go to remedial training because they thought they knew how to do X, and maybe not so much. You know, they have to have a refresher course or something along those lines. So training can be both a hammer and a piece of sugar as well. Get that carrot out there. So know how you can apply both sides of that sword, that training sword, as you're moving along. And during the course of a project, perhaps you see someone who isn't performing the way they should, some remedial training just to bolster their capabilities may not be a bad thing. And no matter what you do for training, you want to update that bottom bullet down there, update your staffing management plan so that it shows that person, hey, now has been trained. Maybe they got a certification, they got their PMP or some other certification, and now they're capable of doing X, whatever the X happens to be. Moving on to the next slide, there are team-building activities that you can run through, several different types of those. Often team members don't initially know each other, so if you can get your team together somehow, great. You can take them to a golf course. My youngest son, just with his team, was off at some exclusive golf course this past Monday, playing golf as a team as their team-building exercise. He had a great time. They did a lot of bonding and things along those lines. It works very well if you can make it happen. You can get everybody in one spot, but in a lot of groups we don't. Maybe there's a virtual team building activity you can do. We've seen those as well. So figure out some way to get the teams to be aware of each other, interact on a non-project basis, if you will, and see what you can do to bolster their interaction with each other. As it will help you resolve a whole lot of things if you can do that. And your job is to bring everyone together anyway, so you need to make sure that you follow through with other team-building activities so that you can get everybody marching in the same direction to the same tune at the same time. And you do that with recognition and reward as well. Okay, so I'm going to move on to the next slide. Some of the things you can do, there's a variety of different things you can do. Getting a diverse group of people together and to work in the most efficient manner, it's the definition of team-building, but find an event, whatever, that'll work out. And the major exam point down at the bottom of this slide is the exam tends to focus more on the theories behind team building and the characteristic of effective teams, not the individual activities. So you don't necessarily have to get down to knowing golf tournaments and things along those lines, but know the theories that we're about to hit in a couple of slides from now and the characteristics of effective teams, which we'll also hit in a couple of slides from now. Let's join to the next slide and begin to do some of those theories. The first theory we're going to hit tonight is called Team Development Phases. It's put together by a guy named Bruce Tuckman. Basically, it describes how teams develop and mature through stages of development. Most of the texts out there say there are four stages. You see them starting from the lower right-hand side. So forming, storming, norming, performing. They're the four classic phases. Just recently, they've added another one called adjourning, which obviously is when the team is disbanding, but it hasn't been there in the classic batch of the four phases of development. Haven't seen the fifth stage in the test just yet, but they could pop it in at any point in time. And the way it works, you approach, if you're looking at the slide, a matrix of basically four squares, starting in the lower right-hand corner with forming. This is the beginning. Everyone's just getting together. You're having your kickoff meeting. And people sort of know the names. They see the organization chart. They know stuff is there. But they learn why they're working together. And in this phase, everyone's going to be very formal. They're going to be all business, so to speak. And then after the first meeting or two, sometimes it only takes one meeting to get to the next stage, and that is storming. Now, storming can be good and it can be bad. This is where a lot of action starts to happen, because now you're going to start to see people play off of each other. Somebody is a know-it-all, they're going to let you know they're the know-it-all. Someone is very quiet, you're never going to hear a peep out of them. And as the project manager, you have to balance things and make sure that everybody has the opportunity to state whatever it is they want to say, work together, and you've got to hold all that together as you're moving forward. Now, storming's not bad. It just means that people are trying to figure out why they're there, make sure that the project scope is what they think it is, so they can contribute. People want to contribute for the most part. If you're dealing with professional people, so they want to make sure that things are set up so they can provide the most that they can, and with through that they get either stature, status, or whatever. And then we move across to norming. This is where you really start to see that the team flourish. They're going to calm down. Everybody, I'll say, knows their place on the team, whatever that you can take that as a positive or a negative, but everyone knows what they're supposed to be doing. And they can really rock and roll. They can really move quickly now because they've got their roles set up. They know what they have to do. Decisions are made jointly. If you're working in an Agile project, we won't talk about Agile so much for the exam, but this is where the team can be self-managed, but we won't get into that for the exam, sort of don't worry about it. But decisions can be made jointly. Maybe the project manager doesn't even need to be there because the team knows how the project manager is going to come down on a particular decision. So they're really performing. They're getting to the point where they really know what they're doing, and then they finally reach the next phase, which is performing. Now they're really rocking and rolling. Everything is very well laid out. Everybody knows what's going on. There's a high level of trust between everybody, and things are just rocking and rolling. And that's going to continue on until one of two things happen. It will continue on until the project ends, and you get into the adjourning phase, which everybody says, hasta la vista, we'll see you on the next project, or somebody new enters the team, or somebody leaves the team. So three things. Project ends, somebody enters the team, somebody leaves the team. When that happens, you start back at square one. You start back at forming. Why? Because that new resource that's come on may have different ideas, may have different statures, may have different whatever. And the team has to go through all four phases again. Now, chances are, second time through, it's not going to take as long to reach the performing phase, but you have to go through it. Okay, with that, I'm going to move to the next slide and talk basically some of the things I just finished saying. So to sum up with some of these phases, different teams progress through the stages of development at different rates. So if a team's worked together before, perhaps, they've already gone through some of these types of things, so they can blow right through forming and storming and get right to norming. Because maybe there's only one or two new people, who knows what the case may be. Or someone's totally new and things are totally messed up, it could take forever to get through the storming stage. You never know. And as I mentioned, the second major exam point there, when somebody new enters or somebody leaves, you do it all over again. And the third bullet there, according to Tuckman, leaders adapt their leadership styles as teams develop. That means leaders have to be much more involved in the forming and the storming stages, but maybe not so much in the norming, and certainly a lot less in the performing. And then as the adjourning phase comes in, if you're following that, the project manager comes back in to make sure everyone exits appropriately. They have another project to go to, that type of thing. But the style and the amount of leadership varies depending on which of those boxes you are in. Okay, moving on to the next slide. Then we get into something called team focus. This is where the team members know and understand the goals and objectives of your project. They know exactly what they need to do. They can see the light at the end of the tunnel, and it's not an oncoming train. It's what they have to get to, and everybody works toward it. So they're all focused on getting things done. They're all marching in the same direction, to the same tune, at the same time. Right? And they're going to use filters that I'll talk about in a moment to see and hear things based on that, and you have to make sure that you use the right communication skills to sort of work your way through those communication issues and make sure your message is received. So let's go to the next slide and talk about communication a little bit. Communication is the process of exchanging information that normally has three different elements to it. It has a sender, it has a message, and it has a receiver. Now, a sender can be an individual or a group of individuals. The message is normally simple or complex, but it's there. And the receivers can be one individual or group of individuals. And so as a sender, you need to make sure that your information is complete and presented in a way that the receiver will probably have a high chance of understanding, receiving and understanding that message. And it wants to be relevant to the receiver as well. If you're sending them an irrelevant message, you know, they just blow it off. They won't worry about it, so that's not a good thing to do. So the message is the information that you're actually sending, and it can be in a whole lot of different ways: written, verbal, nonverbal, formal, informal, internal, external, horizontal, vertical. A whole lot of different things can go into that, but you've got some piece of information that you are sending. In case you're not sure what horizontal message is, that's something you send to peers. So it's going horizontally across the organization, maybe up or down one or two levels, but basically it's not a high vertical jump. Where vertical communication is, you're going way up. You're going up to executive management, or your executive management's going way down, as the case may be, depending upon what you're looking at. Your message has to fit a whole lot of different things. So let's go to the next slide and talk about pictorially how a message moves along. And it all depends upon the filters involved. So what you're looking at, for those that don't have a screen, we're looking at a big rectangle, and inside the rectangle are a bunch of smaller rectangles on the either ends. The rectangle is horizontal, and on the left-hand side of you've got the sender. On the right-hand side, you have the receiver. All right. So on the left-hand side, the sender is going to take his or her message. They're going to encode the message. They're going to put it in the format that they think is going to be accepted and relevant to the receiver. And they're going to send that message along a wire or however they're going to do it. And it goes from the left-hand side of the large rectangle to the right-hand side of the large rectangle. But before it hits the right-hand side of the large rectangle, there is a filter there. That is that person's individual filter. They don't like to see emails, and you're sending them an email. They don't like to receive phone calls, and you're calling them. They only want to receive text messages, and you're sending them a leather-bound volume or something along those lines. You have to know what their filter is and work your way through that, because otherwise, your message is going to be filtered out as noise. So the other parameter to think about is noise. If it doesn't make it through the filter, it's just noise to the person. They're not going to receive it. But if you do it correctly, your message will make it through the filter, and the receiver on the right-hand side of the rectangle will decode that message. And then they might respond as well. So maybe they have to send a message back. So now they have to do the same thing you just did. They have to take and they have to encode a message. They have to send it along whatever medium they're going to be using. And just before it hits you, you've got your own filters as well. So you need to know what your filters are and maybe suggest to them how to respond. Send me an email. Call me. Send me a text message. Give them a clue what your filters are so they can work their way through the filters if you want to have an answer to this thing. And then once their message has worked through your filters, you will receive the message, you will decode it, and the process is complete, and then you can start all over again with a different message if you want. Okay, but that's the process that you go through. And I'm going to move on to the next slide. And we'll talk about effective team characteristics. And with effective team characteristics, there's a whole bunch of things you're trying to strive for. You're trying to strive for better conflict resolution, for commitment to the project, commitment to the team and to the project manager. Maybe you're trying to get some higher job satisfaction or better communication. And in the end, a more successful project. Those are some of the high-level things that effective team characteristics need. We'll touch first. Let's go to the next slide and talk about the negatives that we need to watch for. And as you look at your team members and what they're producing, you're looking for a lack of motivation. Maybe they just don't care anymore. You want to be able to fix that somehow. Maybe they find that the project work isn't that satisfying. maybe status meetings turn into whining sessions or something along those lines. Maybe people are not communicating at all. They need to communicate in order to be successful. Right? And maybe there's a lack of respect or lack of trust for the project manager or for other team members. So these are the types of things you need to watch out for if you are trying to look for good team characteristics. And what do you have to do in order to maybe resolve some of those? Move to the next slide. We'll talk about some of the ground rules that you have to set up. You need to set those things up early in the team's life cycle so everyone in the team knows what they are. They can be meeting norms, reporting issues. Maybe there's a way to offer suggestions. Who knows what it could be, certain ways to do things. But no matter what it is, you need to outline the ground rules so that up front and early and often is another way to say it, so that they know what acceptable behavior is, and hopefully you will see some increased productivity based on that. All right, so I'm going to move to the next slide, and let's talk about some other things around tools and techniques. Next is co-location. As you work through a project, the PMI will always say, and for the most part I agree with them, that teams will always function more effectively when they're in one geographic location. They can do hallway conversations. They can come in if someone else is having a conversation. They can hear about it. They can walk in. They can do face-to-face. They can immediately see what's going on. And the PMI loves that. So be aware that co-location enables teams to function more effectively because they're just there. And you can get around that to some extent with chat rooms, things along those lines. But as far as the PMI is concerned, looking at the bottom bullet, jumping way down to the bottom bullet for a moment, always choose co-location over geographical dispersion for the exam. If they give you a choice, it is one of the few times we always want to try to choose co-location because they like that much better. Now, there are ways to do things, the ways to do projects if you're not co-located to the greatest extent possible. But if you can, you want to try to get people in the same location as often as you possibly can. So maybe there's a way to have monthly, quarterly, face-to-face meetings or something along those lines. So your team meetings aren't a hassle with people driving back and forth. If you can get the central location, then you don't have to worry so much about it. To the greatest extent possible, use other methods, email, chat, instant messaging. We sort of talked about this. And why? Because they can't see that nonverbal communication. Now, over time, if you develop a style where 99.9% of what you do is on the telephone, then where you only have audio, you can begin to pick out the audio communications that let you know someone doesn't agree with you, or someone is excited, or someone doesn't care, that type of thing. But that takes a little bit more. It's more subtle than the visual stuff. And as we know, just from doing our day-to-day work, a lot of times the nonverbal cues are much more important than what is actually being said. So you have to listen for those little nuances in the people's voices if you happen to not to be co-located. But the greatest extent possible, always try to be co-located, and that's the way it'll work for the test as well. And then the final slide on this part of the tool and techniques is reward and recognition. These are the formal ways of recognizing and promoting desirable behavior. Oh, that was great. Do it again. Well, here's a trinket. Next time you do one, do that, you get another one. So you're bolstering the behavior, the good behavior, and you're downplaying the bad behavior. That's reward and recognition. So you need to develop ways to do that. What are the criteria? Make sure everyone knows what the criteria is, especially if you're talking about financial awards, monetary awards. Nothing talks like money does. So if you're going to do money, make sure that everybody knows what the criterion is. If you're handing out little squishy balls, maybe you don't have to be as accurate, or you know, things along those lines. You're handing out cookies or something like that, maybe you don't have to be so accurate. But money, you definitely have to nail it right on the head, be very precise on what qualifies for a monetary award. Because if you don't, you can kill morale. If you haven't established all this stuff and you just hand them out willy-nilly, you just hand them out without any rhyme or reason. Or if you hand them to the same person each time, or the same group of people each time. Other people go, why are they getting another one? Look at what I've done over here. And it starts, it's a demotivator. You want to make sure you pay attention to that. And for the exam, they'll probably have a question or so about that as well. You need to consider individuals' preferences. There may be some people who don't want to be called out. It happens. Some people thrive on attention. Others want to stay in the background all the time. So know what the preferences are for everyone on your team. And you need to understand a lot of the theories of motivation as you're working through things with reward and recognition so that you apply the right theory at the right time and be successful. You can tailor your recognition and reward program or whatever you're doing to meet some of those theories. And there's a bunch of theories, so we should get into talking about them. So let's move on to the next slide, and we'll start talking about the motivational theories that will be on the test, guaranteed. These are all going to be here in some way, shape, or form. We'll talk about four of them right now, actually five. Maslow's hierarchy of needs, Herzberg, and the hygiene theories. That's two together, but they go hand in hand. And then expectancy theory and achievement theory. So let's move on to the next slide and talk about the first one. Pretty much everybody, if you're working in a project arena, has heard about Maslow's hierarchy of needs. It's a triangle. It starts at the bottom with the physiological stuff, air, food, water, that type of thing. And once you have most of those needs satisfied, you can move up a level, get into safety, that type of thing. And once you have safety and family together, then you can move to love and belonging and such, friendship, family, sexual intimacy, those types of things. And once you're together there, you can develop self-esteem, so you're up to the next to the last level of esteem. And once you're very highly confident, you have a good picture of yourself, a good self-image, you can become self-actuated and get really up to the top. But just remember, for the exam, you start down at the bottom, and you don't go higher until most, doesn't have to be all, but a goodly number of the stuff in the lower levels is satisfied. And if one of those ones at lower level disappears, then you drop back down as well. So you can go up, and you can come right back down again as well. Moving on to the next slide, we have the Herzberg and hygiene theories. They go by a couple other names. The exam will tend to call them Herzberg and hygiene, but just in case, the hygiene theory is also called the motivation hygiene theory as well. Why? Because it talks about motivating factors. It was developed by a guy named Frederick Herzberg. It postulates two things that contribute to motivation. One is called hygiene, the other is motivators. So for hygiene factors, it's the work environment that they're talking about here, and that hygiene factors prevent dissatisfaction. What's a hygiene factor? Pay, benefits, work conditions, relationships with your managers and your peers. Those are all things that are nice to have when they're good, so they, as long as they're good, they prevent dissatisfaction. And being paid for the work prevents the satisfaction, but doesn't necessarily bring satisfaction in and of itself. It's just one piece of what's going on there. And then we have motivators. Motivators deal with the substance of the work itself, and basically the satisfaction that you get from performing the work. So if you are highly motivated, you're going to have satisfaction, and the ability to advance and the opportunity to learn new skills and things like that are all motivators. These are things that transcend, if you will, the pay, the work environment. See, I really would like to learn X. If you're a spreadsheet geek, I really would like to learn how to do pivot tables or something along those lines, or matrix math or whatever the case may be. So you're motivated to do that. So the fact that the company may not pay you to take a class may not matter to you. You may fund it yourself or something along those lines. So that's what they're talking about when they say those types of motivators. Okay, so I'm going to move on to the next slide. Now we're talking about expectancy theory, first proposed by Victor Vroom. This is the expectation of a positive outcome will drive the motivation. So if I do X, I'm going to get Y, and I really want Y. So that's just the expectation drives the behavior. Now, everyone's idea of what's good varies. So one person's motivator is not another person's motivator. Another way to say that is the strength of the expectancy drives the behavior, the second exam point there. That if you really, really think that if you do X, you're going to get Y. If you finish the job correctly, your manager is going to give you a car. Right? If you really think that's going to happen, you're going to work your tail off to get that car. But if your manager promises you a car and you know they've never done it before, it's a minor project, why would someone give you a car for doing good? You're not going to believe it. You're not going to work that hard necessarily in order to get that car. So in the negative side of things, there's no expectancy there, so there's no motivation to make things happen. In the example they show there, if you tell a two-year-old to put the toys back, you get a cookie, then chances they're going to put their toys away. It makes common sense. It's a lot of these theories work on everybody, no matter what age you happen to be. So that's how that works out. And the bottom exam point there, people become what you expect of them. So if you're a positive type of project manager, project leader, and you openly praise the people, you tell them they're doing a great job, because they are, and you have a generally positive environment, they're going to do well for you. That's the way people are. They want to please their leaders, their managers. Conversely, if you treat them like dirt and you criticize them all the time, you just have a bad environment because you're down on them all the time. You're in their face all the time yelling at them. Nothing they do pleases you type of thing. You didn't expect them to do so well. They're not going to expect so much, and they're going to become what you expect. And lo and behold, they did not. Okay, so that's what the expectancy theory on the other side is all about. Moving on to the next slide. And then we have the achievement theory. This is proposed by David McClellan, tweaked by a few people here and there. Basically said that people are motivated by the need for three things: achievement, power, and affiliation. Achievement is just what it sounds like, the need to achieve or succeed. Okay, power is just what it sounds like as well. You now have the ability to influence the behavior of others, and it can be a whole different array of power we'll talk about in a moment. And affiliation. This is, you have a relationship with certain people, relationship with your team members, relationship with an organization type of thing. So you're affiliated with the elite group in your company. So that type of thing. And that drives the behavior. And the strength of your team members' desire for each one of those three things, achievement, power, and affiliation, will drive their behavior of getting there. Okay? And now I'm going to move off to the next slide, and we're going to talk about slightly different twist. Now we're going to talk about leadership versus management, but it all has to do with reward and recognition and the tools and techniques around developing the team. There was five different theories. Theory X, Theory Y is one. Theory Z is next, and then contingency theory, leading versus managing, and power. Okay, so I'm going to move to the next slide and talk about Theory X and Theory Y. This is put out by Douglas McGregor, and it basically has two models that try to explain how different managers deal with their team members. First is Theory X. Theory X, and there's a bunch of exam points in here as well. Theory X, the first exam point, Theory X managers believe that most people do not like to work. They will try to steer clear of it whenever possible, that they have little to no ambition, constantly needs to be supervised, and wouldn't do anything for you unless they're threatened. And so you treat people like that. People like that are dictators. They impose very rigid controls. And it's just people motivated by punishment only, pretty much. Or maybe money, maybe position. But you have to be down on them all the time. But on the other hand, Theory Y is the opposite of that. Managers believe people are really interested in doing their best, doing the right things with the right motivation. If you can find the right things to motivate these people and set the proper expectations, they're going to flourish. These managers provide support for their teams. They communicate a lot. They are very supportive, are good listeners. And Theory Y managers tend to believe people are created and committed to doing the right thing so that the project is successful. Now, as you go through that, there's a little side note. If you do a brain dump, what I like to tell people, if they're doing a brain dump, you should have all these things on your brain dump. But if you have a Theory X and Theory Y, what I tell them to put is a little smiley face, actually two smiley faces of varying degrees. For the Theory X face, that's got a frown instead of a smile, and it has X's for the eyes. So the theory is the eyes, Theory X, frown face. Theory Y, on the other hand, we have a smile on it and use Y for the eyes. So that's one way to remember Theory X, Theory Y. One of the other people I had in one of my study groups a year or two or three ago said, well, I don't like smiley faces. I'm going to use stick figures. And I'm going to say a woman's stick figure is Theory Y and a man's stick figure is Theory X. So use whatever you want to portray the theory, but one is good, one is not so good. So make sure you understand which one you want to use and follow through with that. Okay, moving on to the next slide. Then is Theory Z, developed by Dr. William Ouchie. And this is something that was prevalent in Japan in the 80s. This is where theory results in increased productivity. Puts an emphasis on the well-being of both the employees at work and outside of work. So it's the level of loyalty to the organization is one way to say it. You have a job for life, you're going to be loyal, you're going to do the right things, you're going to do everything you can to make sure that your company succeeds. In this day and age, Theory Z is kind of downplayed now with all the flat commerce going on. You're not going to have a job necessarily for life, so Theory Z isn't applied as often, maybe a better way to say that. Going to move on to the next slide, talk about contingency theory. This is a combination of why behaviors and hygiene theory. And it basically states in that exam point there that people are motivated to achieve a certain level of competency, whatever it happens to be, for that individual, and will continue to be motivated by this need even after reaching that level. Why? Because maybe they want the next level up, or if they're happy with where they are, they'll stay there, and they won't look back. They'll just stay right where they're at. So it's a good combination of both theory why and the hygiene theory. Moving on to the next slide, we'll talk about leadership versus management. Basically here, leadership is about imparting vision and rallying people around that vision, because leaders inspire, they motivate, they get people to do what needs to be done. They don't do it themselves, basically. They get other people to do it. Why? Because they have power. They have the ability to get people to do what they wouldn't necessarily do, and maybe there's some politics involved in it as well, because no matter what happens, leaders understand the difference between power and politics, and they employ those strategies, those differences, in order to get things done. They don't necessarily know how to do the nitty-gritty details. That's for managers to do, like I get into in a moment, but these are the visionaries, if you will. Well, managers and management, on the other hand, are generally task-oriented, and they're concerned with the nitty-gritty stuff, the plans, the controls, the budgets, the policies, and whatever. They tend to be generalists with a broad base of planning and organizational skills, and what they're really trying to do is satisfy the stakeholders' needs. When you come right down to it, and they have those motivational skills, those soft skills required to get the most out of everybody, and they can actually apply that rewarding behavior, or maybe the leader can't. And moving on to the next slide, let's talk about power for a little bit here, because leaders have power, and we need to understand how it works. And power is basically, as we said, the ability to influence people to do what you want them to do. It can be a positive power. It can be a negative power. Leaders and managers can use power interchangeably to convince others to get things done. The kind of power that they use will depend upon them, you, the project, company culture, that type of thing. And the project manager can use several forms in order to get things done. It all depends on what works in your organization. So let's talk about the types of power on the next slide. There's a few. There's reward power or penalty power. There's expert power, formal or legitimate power, and referent power. So let's talk at the top of the list here. Reward power is basically that just as it sounds. You can grant bonuses, pay raises, incentive awards, things along those lines. Conversely, if it's penalty power, you won't get this reward, you won't get this, you won't get the training, you won't get something if you don't meet their expectations. So it can go either way. Expert power, on the other hand, is when the person believes the person doing the influencing is knowledgeable about the subject or has special abilities that make them an expert. So they know something that you don't, and so that makes them the expert. And you can become the expert if you work at it, is another way to look at it. So that's what expert power is all about. Then it's formal or legitimate power. This becomes maybe where the person is in the organization. Where if it's the CEO or the CIO or something like that, they have that formal legitimate power because they're much higher than you are in the organization chart. Pretty straightforward. Then there's referent power. This is referred to by whoever's wielding the power gets given to them by their subordinates. Maybe they have the team members have a great deal of respect for person A because of something that they've done. Maybe they have been around for a long time, they have great wisdom, or they have a particular skill or something along those lines that makes the other people look up to them. So they do. And if someone on your team has referent power, you want to make sure you can take advantage of that to the extent possible. Okay, so with that, that's all the tools and techniques. Let's talk about outputs on the next slide. There are two of them, team performance assessment and EEF updates. And we're only going to talk about team performance assessment because we've already talked about EEF updates. So let's move to the next slide, where we see team performance assessment, and this involves the formal and informal assessments of a team's success. You can do management by walking around. You can look and see what people are doing. You can have them submit written things, status summaries, things along those lines, but you're looking around, doing maybe some team building experiences to see just what's there. Are individuals improving? Is the team behaving well? Are they moving at the right speed at the right time? Are they resolving conflicts, if any come up? Are they recommending other ways to do things? Improvements, continuous improvement is always a big deal. So are they doing all the right types of things? And as you assess these, you'll be able to figure out ways to improve your team. the manager, to do a formal assessment where you ask people, or just an informal one you observe. It depends on your organization and what you want to do. But somewhere along the lines, you do an assessment of just how the team's performing. Okay? So that is that process. And we'll move to the next slide. And now we're going to touch on the last process of the session. And we'll get through this one and call it quits. This is Manage Project Team. It's number 9.4. If you look at our graphic down there, which is figure 9-11 from the PMBOK, we've got 5 inputs, 5 tools and techniques, 4 outputs. And we'll move to the next slide, and we'll talk about Manage Project Team. This is basically concerned with tracking and reporting on what's going on. You're actually doing the day-to-day management of what's going on. You're doing performance appraisals both for the team point of view and for an individual. Some team behavior is observed during this process to make sure the team is doing well. And the exam point there, the PMBOK states that one of the outcomes or results of the Managed Project Team power is an update to the staffing management plan, which means as you see something that needs to be changed based on your observations, then you go and you update, you tweak the plan just the way it sounds. Now, maybe things are going so well that you can change the way you manage something, or things are going so poorly that you have to change the way you manage something. But you'll notice that staffing management plan updates are not listed as an output of this process when we get to the output. So if you're going to do anything to your project management plan, just remember you have to do the updates. And I'm going to move on to the next slide, and we'll talk about the inputs. There's 5 of them. They are project staff assignments, project management plan, team performance assessment, performance reports, and organizational process assets, some other different pieces of the OPAs. We're going to talk about the last two because we've already talked about project staff assignments, project management plan, and team performance assessment. So let's move to the next slide and talk about performance reports. And these are basically our documentation, how things are going. You're going to be providing those up to your sponsors, up to your management, whatever the case may be. Your team members may be providing them to you as well. So it is a matter of documenting what's been done. These performance areas can have a wide continuum of things you're going to look at: cost, schedule, quality, scope, all kinds of other things that you can pay attention to. So depending upon your organization, and for the test, you just want to make sure you hit the main ones: schedule, cost, scope, those types of things. And information from these can be turned into forecasts so that you know what's going to be needed for the future. Are you going to need to change your human resource requirements or your rewards or recognition or something else based on what these performance reports tell you? And as you're doing all this stuff, as far as OPA updates, perhaps you're going to create a certificate of appreciation or a newsletter or websites or anything along those lines. You want to stick those back into your OPAs so that the people that come behind you can use those as well. You don't necessarily want to just hold them on your own. There's a lot of people that are coming behind you, and they can really use those things as well. So don't be shy about sharing them. I'm going to move on to the next slide and talk about tools and techniques. There are a few of those. They are observation and conversation, project performance appraisal, conflict management, issue log, interpersonal skills. We'll talk about everything except interpersonal skills, because we've already talked about that one. So let's move to the next slide and talk about observation and conversation. It's what you do in order to see what's happening. You look and you talk. All right, so it's what you're going to do to assess team performance, either from an individual or, well, it says team, so obviously from a team point of view, but you can do it from an individual point as well. It's communication that you have to do within your team, let them know how they're doing, and outside of your team, let management know what they're doing. And you need to set up some standards. Maybe you're going to tell people they can come to you anytime, have an open door policy, they can say what they want, whatever the case may be. But you need to make sure that the team knows how approachable you are or are not. Hopefully you're an approachable kind of person, and you'll be the person they come to if they have an issue. Or maybe they'll work it with one of the referential leaders of the team, and they'll tell you about it. And then as you have things you're working through, there's an issue log. This is where you keep track of all the stuff that's going on, issues that come up, things that you've overcome as you are meeting your project goals. They can be in easy, small things. They can be large, difficult things. Anything, maybe as you work through your project, you found some new responsibility, perhaps that needs to happen you didn't think of before. You want to document that and staff to take care of it. So So each issue needs to be recorded along with who's responsible for resolving it. And once you've finally resolved it, put a date down there so that if you have to remember how long ago somebody fixed something, you can do that. Moving on to the next slide. There are project performance appraisals. These are looking at the objectives for conducting performance appraisals. You want to make sure they include clarification of the roles and responsibilities. What type of constructive feedback are you giving to your team members and are you receiving from your team members? It's bidirectional or can be bidirectional. Any discovery of issues, you want to define your unknown unknowns. Quickly as possible, turn them into known unknowns, and very quickly beyond that, turn them into known knowns, if you will, and deal with them as quickly as you can. Maybe there's other training plans from both a team point of view, from an individual point of view you have to deal with, and any goals. It's a standard performance appraisal, but you're doing it for the team. And make sure that you document all these things and make sure that depending upon how long your project is, you do them at regular enough intervals. If you've got a project that lasts a month, chances are quarterly performance reviews aren't going to cut it. So you've got to set your timing to something that is appropriate given the length of the project, the size of the organization, all those EEF type of things that we talked about earlier. Okay, moving on to the next slide. Then we have the project performance appraisal, a little bit more on that. These are basically annual, semi-annual things. Let the managers, where their managers, let the employees know what they think of their performance and rate them accordingly. The main point for showing the slide is the main exam point there where we have a 360-degree view. And basically what that means is a lot of times you can have employees do peer-to-peer type of inputs. They give inputs on their peers. They give inputs on you. It can go in various directions. So it depends on what your organization allows is the point there. And as you're doing these, beware of loyalty issues. Some people who are more attracted to each other from a technological point of view or whatever, more loyalty point of view, they might tend to give better reviews for people they're more loyal to than others or organizationally. Maybe they're more loyal to the programming group as opposed to the testing group or something along those lines. You know, so be aware of those types of things. And as you're doing performance appraisals, look at your training needs as well, is the point there. Okay, moving on to the next slide. Now, as we're going through teams, we sometimes run into conflicts, as we talked about a few slides ago. We need to worry about how we're going to manage conflict. If you have some conflict, you'd like to try to deal with it as soon as it arises. If it comes along, you're managing your project team processes, most conflicts come about as a result of scheduling, technology, professional, personal work habits, those types of things. So pay attention to those and try to deal with them in private if you can so that they are taken care of relatively quickly. You want to do it in a direct and collaborative manner, but you might be prepared to escalate the issue to a more formalized procedure if necessary. If conflicts exist between two or more team members, try to encourage them to work it out without outside intervention or intervention from yourself. But if they can't, then you have to get involved. And the best conflict resolution will come about when they can do the work it out between them. It's called problem solving, as you'll see in a couple of slides. When that isn't possible, you step in and set up some ground rules ahead of time so they know how to deal with conflict. So let's move on to the next slide and begin to talk a bit more deeply about conflict and what to do about it. As we said, it's the incompatibility of goals. One party has one goal, another party has another one, and they're either resisting or blocking the other party from attaining. As we said, it can be out of schedule, priorities, resources, technical options or opinions, or whatever the case may be. So let's move to the next slide and talk about strategies for dealing with conflict. There are five of them. The first is smoothing. Smoothing does not lead to a permanent solution. It's temporary. If there's a conflict, someone will say, well, that doesn't matter. We can deal with that later on. Don't worry. It's not such a big deal. Finally, people are convinced, oh, yeah, okay, all right, I guess it isn't such a big deal, and they walk away. Well, what really happens is that's a lose-lose situation because later on, a week or so down the road, or when they get back to the desk, well, yeah, that really is a big deal, and I just gave that up. So it's a lose-lose situation. So smoothing is not good. Then there's withdrawal. That never results in any type of resolution as well. Because somebody just walks away. It's lose-lose. Because one party gets up and they just leave. It's just the way it sounds. So it's lose-lose. It's not a good thing. Moving on to the next slide. Then there's compromise. Compromise is achieved when each of the parties involved gives up something. They haven't maybe given it a whole lot of thought. They found some low-hanging fruit where it looks like that it's agreeable, but in the end, neither side wins and neither side loses. Both sides are sort of, I guess that'll work. They're not really gung-ho about things, but it resolves the conflict. But the conflict could come back if someone decides they don't want to give up what they gave up. And then it's confrontation, which is also called problem solving. This is really the best way to resolve conflict, because when you do this, when you get in a confrontation, you're actually trying to come up with yet another solution. Maybe there's a different way to do things so that the situation you're dealing with will not come up again. This is really a win-win situation, because you're working on it, you come up with a permanent, effective solution that everybody likes. No one has given up a thing, perhaps, and it's a win-win type of thing. And then there's forcing, which is just like it sounds. One person forces a solution on everybody else, and it's a matter of, okay, I'm the boss, you're going to do it this way. Never a good thing to do. So now we have to look at outcomes. Let's look at the next slide. We're almost done for the session, and we're going to look at outcomes. There are four of them. There are four outcomes. First is a stalemate, and where nothing happens. Nobody wins. Better way to say it. Stalemate. Then there's resolution, and that's when an end state is reached in which both parties are satisfied. That's that win-win situation. And then beyond that, there's either winning or losing. You lost or you won, just like it sounds. One party triumphs over another. So how do you play all these things together? We're like five slides left, and we're done for the session. What we're going to do is look at the slide that has the grid on it. We've got three rectangles on this slide. Blue one on the top left shows the strategies for working conflict resolution. They are withdrawal, smoothing, compromise, confrontation, and forcing. You notice the bold letters for the two C's, because they both have start with CO, so we can't do a C for those. So we say CMP or CNF for compromise and confrontation, F for forcing, and then in the yellow square, we see outcomes. Stalemate, resolution, or somebody wins in the yellow square. Now look down the bottom. You have a grid. And the grid shows two parties. Party A is the column header. So on the column header, you see WS, CMP, CNF, and F. Those are the strategies employed by Party A as they're working toward resolution. Looking now on the row headers, Party B, you see the same strategies, WS, CMP, CNF, and F. These are the strategies that Party B is going to apply to a particular problem. And the way you use this matrix is depending upon which party uses what strategy, you can figure out the outcome. Okay, everybody clear on all that? Then what you do is you just look at the cell. If both Party A and Party B are executing a withdrawal strategy, the result is a stalemate. Nobody wins, nobody loses. And then the next one in the next column. If Party A does a smoothing strategy while Party B does a withdrawal strategy, then Party A is going to win that. They're going to come away with what they want. Why? Because Party B is withdrawing. They don't care. That's why the arrow is pointing up toward Party A. Conversely, I'll go down to one of the cells with the arrow pointing in the left-hand direction. Let's pick the column, the smoothing column on Party A, and the confrontation, the row is with Party B. With confrontation, that's problem solving, remember. So Party A is going to want to smooth it over. They just want it to make it go away, while Party B is actually problem solving, coming up with a resolution. Party B is going to win that. So the arrow is pointing to Party B. Okay, so here's how things get resolved based on the use of strategies with two sides. This grid won't be on the test, but they might ask you a question saying, Party A uses a smoothing technique and Party B uses a forcing technique. Smoothing and forcing. Who's going to win? Party B is going to win because the arrow is pointing at Party B. Okay, that's what the test question will be like. So using this chart here, using this matrix, you'll be able to figure it out.
If you can put this matrix on your brain dump, it will help you to figure that out if you have time to throw that on your brain dump. So that's how easy this whole thing is to apply. Okay, so I'm going to move on to the next slide. And we'll talk about the outputs, and then we'll be done with the session. There are four of them, EEF updates, OPA updates, change requests, and project management updates. Moving to the next slide, we talk about our EEF updates. These are perhaps there's some new organizational things that are coming along you have to pay attention to. So you're going to whatever, maybe do something for performance appraisals, anything along those lines that are impacted by your organization. You need to make sure that you include in your EEF updates any personnel skill updates. Somebody's become a certified PMP. You put that in your EEF updates because that person can now do more things. Same thing with your OPA updates. If you've come up with a template, if you've come up with some other historical information or come up with something else, develop a standardized process, stick that in the OPAs. Let other people coming behind you use that. That'll be the best thing moving forward. Speaking of moving forward, let's go to the next slide. We'll talk about change requests. A change request, staff changes from time to time, either by a controllable event, a promotion, or an uncontrollable event. Somebody quits, something like that. Who knows? And it's going to impact your plan. So when a change comes up, make the request. If you have to go to your sponsors, do that. See what they can do to help you out. Maybe you have to add X number of people to your project. In some organizations, you have to go through a change control process for that. That's what that second bullet is all about. If you have to go through a change control process with perform integrated change control process, then you do that. But it's going to depend on your organization. So people can move all over the place. We've got different assignments, part of the whole staffing management plan that we talked about way in the very beginning of the session. So make sure that if you can prevent people from going that shouldn't go, you can. But if there's a good reason for having people go, then by all means, they're being promoted, let them go to another project, those types of things. But take care of that. Work through that with change requests. And then finally, on the last slide, we have project management plan updates. And this is where, as you make changes to your project management plan, you capture those, make sure that everybody knows what's in there, that you know what's in there for sure, what your sponsors know, that you've updated the plan, and see what you can do in order to fulfill the rest of your plan moving forward. With that, that's it for the session. I'm going to take you folks off of mute and ask if there are any questions.
I got some. This is Judy.
Hey, Judy. How you doing?
Okay. The performance appraisals for individuals, where do they go? They just go to their individual personnel file?
So they can certainly go to the personnel file and go to the individual themselves as well. I would not necessarily stick a filled-out performance appraisal in an OPA, but I would take one and maybe make it generic. Maybe take the person's name off or come up with a generic one, you know, person A, Bob, Sally, you know, throw something else so somebody has, or just take the blank form and stick that into an OPA. Certainly your organization has a format they want to do for performance appraisals. So, yes, the filled out one goes to the employee, to their personnel file, and nowhere else.
Okay. The second question relates to confrontation.
Mm-hmm.
In several of the environments I come from, the word confrontation is not looked at as positive.
Yep. Okay. Yep.
Is this more applied to project management?
No, it can be team members as well, or anything. You can have conflict in a baseball team, you know, any group of individuals working together or not working together, as the case may be, can stem conflict, can breed conflict. If you're going to work together toward a common goal of project success, then somebody has to resolve the conflict. And it depends on just who's going to do that. You can use those techniques that I talked about or maybe come up with some of your own, but it needs to be addressed for sure.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have no problem with confrontation, but the other party may have, you know.
Exactly, yeah. They may always take the withdrawal approach, which may work for you, but it might not solve the overall problem that you're trying to address. So just because you win doesn't mean you win, you know, that type of thing.
Yep.
Maybe you'd have to talk with your project leader or if you talk with your sponsor and say, I've got issue X, and now I'm going to do this to get around issue X because of conflict.
Yep, good. Thank you so much.
I mean, you're welcome, Judy.
And that's a lot of materials that's not covered in PMBOK at the end.
Yes, it's part of the reason for doing these sessions, to give you that critical mass to allow you to pass the test on the first try. Hey, I think I even say that in the beginning of the session, didn't I? Who knew? Sure. Any other questions out there?
Yeah, one question.
Yeah, Judy.
The recognition and reward system, does that apply to all projects or some only highly visible projects?
Well, it certainly can apply to all. If you're building a deck on your house and you're done, your recognition and reward, you might have a party or something like that. You know, it certainly can apply to all projects. It just depends on the extent to which your organization allows that reward and recognition. You know, some organizations, there are achievement awards if you finish a highly valued project. And with others, you get nothing. You might get a piece of paper. You might get nothing. I've been on plenty of projects where I've received nothing from being on the team, But certainly any project I've tried to run, I've been a leader for, at the end of the project, I try to come up with a kind email, a certificate, a something. Hey, thanks for working with me. I'll be happy to work with you again. I try to provide inputs to their managements for performance appraisals and things along those lines. I deal with a lot of people that don't work in my organization. Anytime I run across some of those folk, I make note of them. I try to make a little note so that when it comes time for performance review season, which in a lot of companies is annually, sometimes it's more frequently, sometimes it's every other year. But in your company, you're going to know when it's performance review season, and about a month before is when I start writing things up. In fact, ours is right now at HP, July 30th, try again. October 31st is the end of the fiscal year. Right now, we are in prime performance review solicitation season. So I spend a lot of time sending off little snippets to people's management.
Well, this was very good. Thank you very much.
Well, you're very welcome. And
thank you.
We'll continue through this and continue on so folks can get the studying done and actually sit for the test. We've had a lot of people in the past few months pass the test, those who have been part of this group and part of some of my other groups. I think I've had a dozen people go through and pass the test on the first try since like April and May. In fact, Dinesh is still on with us. He passed.
Yes, and I'm here.
Yeah, on the first try. So we have a lot of good testimonials for what we do here. And speaking go ahead.
I do have a question on the test. Right. Hearing more and more that 62% or whatever is no longer considered passing score, but that there's no score, and that you could even, you know, get 65% and not pass. They're using some kind of psychometrics to evaluate how we respond to the questions.
Have not heard that myself. I can see how if you are testing and you're just barely coming in the 60% range, you're not proficient in a whole lot of areas, you might not pass the test. But certainly, from what I've seen so far, any of the people who have passed the test have shown they're very proficient in certain areas, maybe lacking in one or two. But they don't tell you the score anymore, so it's very difficult.
They stopped giving you the percentage system a long time back.
Right, so you don't know whether you have 65% or 62%.
Yeah, you don't know anything.
Let
tell you the domains, whether you're proficient or not, that's it.
Right.
Next time I see it on LinkedIn, make a note of it.
Yeah, point it out to me, because I sort of follow LinkedIn, but maybe there was something there, and I was in a busy time, and I didn't see it. I'd comment on some of those types of things.
There have been people who score around 60 and still pass because of the way that they approach the questions.
Yeah, well, how do they know they scored 60 is my question. They have no idea. They might have scored maybe a bit higher than 60, but they never know. And if you look at my brain dump that's in the lobby of this virtual room and over on the PM Lessons Learned file area, the back of the brain dump, I propose to you a method to keep track of the questions you're not sure about so that you can maybe guess or come close to what your score might be. And people have used that who have passed the test in the past couple of weeks. I had one person who said, I use your method, but I only wound up marking 10 questions. Well, chances are he probably scored relatively high because even though he only marked 10 questions, even if he got all those 10 questions wrong, he probably got a few of the other ones wrong as well. But the point being, if you're only unsure of 10 questions, you stand a higher probability of passing than if you're unsure of 40 questions or 50 questions.
Yeah.
So that just gives you an idea of where you might stand. It's just one tactic if you have the time to implement it as you're taking the test.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, let me run through my outro here, and then we'll address any other questions that anybody has. As a reminder, PM Lessons Learned conducts 3 conference calls each month. This is the monthly PMP exam study group call and podcast that we're on right now because it's the first Thursday of the month. On the second Thursday of the month, we have the PM Lessons Learned Job Shop call where folks in transition or who need to identify a potential career path can go to help each other out. And finally, on the third Thursday of each month, we hold the PM Lessons Learned Best Practices call. This call provides presentations on a wide variety of project management topics and soft skills. Okay, so that's it for this session of the PM Lessons Learned monthly PMP exam study group call and podcast. I'll again thank the live participants on this conference call and everyone that downloads the podcast. speaking of the podcast, over the past year or so that I've been doing these sessions, you folks have downloaded over 12,000 copies of the monthly exam study podcast. So I really thank you for all of your support. That's a huge number. So we're very popular, and I hope we're helping people pass the test. And if you pass the test, send us a little notification that you passed so we know that we had a small part in your personal achievement, your personal milestone. So I'll remind you that we are PMLessonsLearned.com, project managers helping project managers to make a difference. My name is Dana Safford. So long, and keep on learning.
This has been a PM Lessons Learned podcast. Project managers helping project managers by sharing lessons learned. Come join our group. Visit our website at PMLessonsLearned.com. Till next time, keep on learning.